From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, why aren't more female cinematographers hired to shoot Hollywood movies? Then we hear from the creators of a casual concert series where songwriters are challenged to write a new tune about a given subject on the spot.
We're playing these weird, funny, sometimes amazing, sometimes really terrible songs. I think what it does is it takes you back to the really pure reason you wanted to be a musician and songwriter.
And cellist Yo-Yo Ma deconstructs a Bach piece that has become one of his signature performances. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott, for consideration in all categories.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Fox Searchlight, presenting The Favorite, nominated for 3 Screen Actors Guild Awards for Best Actress Olivia Colman and Supporting Actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz. Awards eligible in all categories.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. With this year's Oscar nominations about 2 weeks away, let's look back on a milestone from last year's ceremony when Sandra Bullock presented this award.
Here are the 4 men and the 1 trailblazing woman who are nominated for Achievement in Cinematography.
That one woman was Rachel Morrison, the director of photography, or DP, for the movie Mudbound. While Morrison didn't take home the Oscar, she still made history. She was the first female DP to get a cinematography nomination in the 90-year history of the Academy Awards. But Morrison is still the exception to the all-male DP rule. Frame producer Monica Bushman has our report.
Why did it take 90 years for a woman to get an Oscar nomination for cinematography? Part of the answer is that there just aren't that many women shooting the kinds of movies that get recognized at the Oscars. Of the 250 top-grossing films of 2018, only 4% had women DPs. That's from the latest celluloid ceiling report that San Diego State University has been doing for 20 years now. And in that time, the numbers haven't changed. The reason for that isn't so easy to answer.
I've never understood why there aren't more female cinematographers.
That's Rachel Morrison, the Oscar-nominated cinematographer herself.
This industry is all about empathizing and channeling emotion into visuals. And it's everything that women do well. So I've never understood what was ever seen as a deficiency and why it's become this complete inequity in terms of, you know, statistically speaking.
And the inequity can become sort of self-perpetuating. Here's how actor, writer, and director Zoe Lister-Jones puts it.
It is this, like, terrible catch-22 where the pool is much smaller of women with a certain level of experience in departments where they're never given opportunities so they can't get the experience.
When Lister-Jones directed her 2017 movie Band-Aid, she hired an all-female crew. But it wasn't easy.
Especially in departments like camera and grip and electric, I think those were the biggest challenges. And also, you know, I think a lot of our crew had to step outside their comfort zones because so many people, women, would say, well, I've been working with this dude for like 10 years. That's my dude. And I would have to say, you have to kind of work with this person who might be a little greener, but it'll be kind of a mentoring experience that then she can get that opportunity on the next one.
Another factor in getting those opportunities is whether you're in the union. On a Friday evening in Hollywood, I went to an event called Navigating the Unions, organized by a nonprofit called Women in Media.
Why are we here and why are we talking about unions?
Executive Director Temma Steig kicked things off.
So we hear a lot about how there aren't women directors, aren't women in DP, you know, like all these positions. There are no women, right? No. I see a few women in the audience and you're all doing work, right? At the indie level, the barrier to entry is getting into the studio projects. You can't work on a studio project unless you're in a union.
Cinematographer Kristen DiLiello was there to learn more about getting into Local 600, the cinematographers' union. She makes a living doing non-union work, mainly web videos for companies like BuzzFeed, but she wants to do more. She has contacts that could get her higher-paying job opportunities, but if it's a union job, she can't take it.
I do have mentors that want to help. That's why also it's more important to me to be in the position where I can take a good job or something that they could set me up with, which I can't right now. So
right now, Kristen's trying to get into the union, but it's a complicated process. She has to prove she's worked 100 days of non-union work within a 3-year period. To do that, she submits proof of her work experience, like pay stubs and letters from employers, to an organization called Contract Services. The cinematographers I spoke with say it's time-consuming and frustrating. Here's Marianne Williams and Leah Anova.
I think the most confusing thing is what kind of days count and what kind of days don't count. The answer is constantly different.
There's always these little rules or regulations that you're not aware of, and it's such a strict process that getting in becomes almost impossible.
And while being in the union can get you bigger gigs, it's expensive. The one-time initiation fee is $15,000, and on top of that, there are quarterly dues. The fees and rules apply to everyone, but when it comes to actually getting hired, it's not always a level playing field for women. Kristen realized that after grad school, on her first interview for a job as a DP.
It was a horror film, and I met with the director, and he said he really liked my work and he liked my reel, but he wasn't sure about working with a woman because he already had a female production designer, and he didn't know about a female DP if he wasn't comfortable.
That director ended up hiring a male classmate of Kristen's, who she thinks was pretty much on her same level, skill-wise.
And that was a really big wake-up call for me, that it wasn't just about my abilities. It was also about just who I am and certain things that you can't do anything about that were going to be a challenge.
I think there's one main reason that everything else stems from is systematic discrimination.
That's cinematographer Alan Queso, who's worked on shows like 6 Feet Under and The Americans.
For somebody like me, a white guy. Yeah, I had my challenges. It was difficult for me to get into the union and all that. But, you know, now in hindsight, looking back on what it's like for people of color and women, it's an impossible hill for them to climb. And I saw this, so I felt like I needed to say something.
Queso said something in a pretty public forum last year when he accepted his Lifetime Achievement Award from the American Society of Cinematographers.
Let's not only kick in some doors for members of minority groups, let's uninstall them for good.
In his speech, Queso admitted that while he'd been talking about the need for diversity and inclusion, he'd only recently recognized that he himself was hiring mostly white male crew members. He pledged to change that and called on his colleagues to do the same.
Let's surround ourselves with a crew who looks like the real world, not like an Ivy League fraternity. Because I promise you, after 30 years in this industry, this I know for sure, it's not a zero-sum game.
Some male directors have stepped up too. Ryan Coogler had Rachel Morrison, the Oscar-nominated cinematographer we heard from earlier, shoot Fruitvale Station. He brought her on for Black Panther, too, making her the first female DP of a superhero movie.
I want to show people that it can be done and to come away with glowing recommendations for the future. I mean, not so much even for me, but just so that then other studios go and hire female DPs to shoot their $150 million movies.
Maybe Morrison's success with Black Panther will have a positive effect. The women I talk to who are still working their way up in their careers say they're committed to staying in the industry. Whether the industry makes space for them to move up remains to be seen. For The Frame, I'm Monica Bushman.
Coming up, a concert series about the songwriting process rather than the song itself.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott. AFI calls the film a stellar achievement in its own universe, and Owen Gleiberman of Variety calls it an emotional knockout. Nominated for 4 SAG Awards, including Outstanding Performance by a Cast, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Supporting Actor, for consideration in all categories, including Best Picture and Best Director.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Most of the time when we see a concert, we really expect the songs to already be written, rehearsed, and arranged into set lists. But what if you based a live show around the songwriting process itself?
Hi, good evening, everybody. So welcome to the Theatricum Botanicum and to Song Club.
A couple of months ago, I moderated an event in Topanga Canyon called Song Club. It's an LA-based performance and conversation series hosted by songwriters Anara George and Eleni Mandel. Under the giant oak trees of the Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum, 10 songwriters took a turn at the mic to share songs they just composed, and some were finishing theirs minutes before taking the stage. The songwriters were given just one requirement.
Either write a song that sounds happy with sad lyrics, or a song that sounds or feels sad with happy lyrics.
When I spoke with Anara George and Eleni Mandel before the event, Mandel began by telling me how Song Club evolved.
So I was teaching songwriting at 2 colleges and a prison.
And I would tell friends of mine and mutual friends of ours, oh, I gave these students the craziest idea. Like, ha, 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 I can't believe what I made them do. And every time I told the story to a musician that's already working making records, they'd always say, oh, I wish I could take a class like that. So I decided to start a club. And I invited a few people. And, you know, once every couple of months, I'd give an assignment, or our friend Alex Lilly gave an assignment, one of the worst and hardest and most exciting assignments, write a political dance song. And then
there's so many.
And then we'd get together and play them for each other and talk about them.
Is the idea to come out of this process with something, or to come out of it with a new way of working or thinking about songwriting? What is the end goal, I guess?
I feel like the end goal is to just exercise that creative muscle. And if you get it wrong, or if you hate it, or if you're embarrassed by it, or if it's amazing, no matter what, it's a worthwhile exercise.
I think sometimes as a songwriter, you can get so precious about everything you do. And to have a thing where it feels like a club and you're doing your best and you bring a song and it maybe doesn't even fit what the assignment was, it's like you still made it happen.
Yeah. And then hearing when everyone has the same assignment and then you hear how many different ways that was interpreted, it's really, really fun.
A couple of people were talking about like method of writing and do you stew on it or ruminate? I just let it rip. I'm spacing out as I slice up these unripe bananas. Look, there goes Satan with Mike Tyson and Tony Montana. It's been a hell of a week. We've seen too many things we can't unsee.
It's just sort of funny and fun, and everyone has a good time. It's one of the best ways to have a party. Because, you know, we're eating, we're having some wine, and then we're playing these weird, funny, sometimes amazing, sometimes really terrible songs, just having fun doing it. In a way, I think what it does is it takes you back to the really pure reason you wanted to be a musician and songwriter.
I think adding the audience might, I don't know, it might actually make it even more fun, because it's, you're kind of, you're just like, okay, I'm walking out in my underpants and let's hope this let's hope it works.
Discombobulated in the backyard, I can't help singing, you're acting suspicious.
And I said singing, but it's saying.
I did think when I started doing it, I thought, I feel like people would be really interested in seeing what this is like. Someone who isn't a musician, to hear all the mistakes or the genius and all the different varieties.
I think there's an assumption that younger, less experienced musicians have a lot to learn from people who have been in it for a long time. But I just know from talking to veteran actors who are often cast against non-professional first-timers, that the veterans end up learning as much from the newbies as the other way around. Have you found that to be true as well?
Absolutely. I invited Richard Moore, who was a former student of mine. He's 21 years old, and he listens to such different music than I listen to, and writes so differently than I do.
I spent the summer writing songs about my lover. I don't think they'll ever know. I spent the summer buried deep inside my covers, too afraid to touch my phone, and I fall like cherries in the spring.
I feel like I definitely learn and get inspired by hearing what younger people are doing, because I've been doing what I do for so long, it's hard for me to break out and try something different.
And I invited Bella Porter, and I saw her at this crossroads. I mean, she was a senior in high school. This was 2 years ago. So she's, I don't think she's legal yet to drink. And she blew me away.
Spent the day at the museum. Laughed so hard at all the artifacts.
I had such a kind of like blind confidence when I was younger, and it's so exciting to see that in younger people.
And how do you avoid the kind of open mic night issue, which is that if you go to an open mic night with comedians who are trying to break it, every comedian is rooting for the other person to fail so that they look better. How do you make sure that everybody is rooting for everybody to do great work? Is it how you cast it?
I feel like it's such a supportive community. And
comedians are dark.
I'm sorry, yeah, right? Musicians are really, really
musicians
uplifting.
Are more, but it's more collaborative. You're in bands. Yeah. You're playing music together all the time. So I think you, it's like it's ingrained in you to root for someone.
I also feel like at the clubs that we've done privately, everyone, you know, will say like, oh, yours was so good. Mine was the worst. No, mine was the worst. Yours was the best.
My friends all call me the third wheel. I have no clue how they feel. It's getting...
What about yourselves? I mean, you have challenged yourself to come up with something following the prompt.
Yeah.
How much do you worry about like what you have to do? And are you able to kind of relax and just say, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. The chips are going to fall wherever they're going to fall.
I definitely think my song is very, very cheesy. And I think that it could make me a lot of money someday, especially on the wedding circuit.
I'm going to slow it down so it gets sadder.
I think what I like best about writing for an assignment is that you can be totally free to make a fool of yourself. And you can just say, it was an assignment, it was an exercise. I don't think that I'll necessarily put this song on a record, but if it's terrible, it might be more fun.
I never thought I'd be loved like this. Oh, your love so big.
I don't know if I really accomplished the assignment, but I tried. Really tried. Put my best foot forward.
And also, this is something I just wrote. I finished it this morning, so it could get a little rough around here.
What should we say to our sons and our daughters?
Now that I'm doing the assignments, I used to give them to students and then just be like, come on, make it happen, do it right. And now I realize that, wow, that's really hard. It's amazing to jump through hoops very quickly like that.
Songwriters often have a lot of difficulty explaining their creative process because sometimes it's something that they don't understand themselves. And kind of the nature of this conversation is they have to talk a little bit about how they come up with a lyric or a melody. Is that part of the challenge as well, to understand your own creative process and share it with people so that they understand how your creative mind works?
I think that's one of the benefits of it, is that when you're writing as self-consciously as you have to, because usually for me, I'm inspiration only. I don't try. I wait until the inspiration hits and then I write. So having to try and having to follow these parameters makes you think about, in this metacognitive way, how you work, what works, you know, like how you make something better if you don't like it, when do you know you're finished, all of those things.
Because this was an assignment, I'm grateful to say that I also felt licensed to use the word love, although a bit bitterly, in this song.
I mean, Eleni's in the same boat because she has two kids. But after having kids, I found I needed to give myself assignments so I could finish a song.
This is called To a Hammer, Everything Looks Like a Nail.
The muse does hit you occasionally, but when you've got to go to grocery shopping, it really kind of gets shoved to the side. So
that's true.
So I do, I could give myself deadlines.
If you want to be lied to, broken down, left on the ground, you could try love.
Nara and Eleni, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Nobody home, you could try love.
During that segment, you heard three singers who were not identified. They were, in order of appearance, Mike Viola, Bea Beeman, and Dan Wilson. Coming up, Yo-Yo Ma takes us inside his long-standing and deep connection to Bach's cello suites.
Try a little love if you wanna cry.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Favorite, nominated for a leading 14 Critics' Choice Awards, including lead actress Olivia Colman, supporting actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, acting ensemble, original screenplay, editing, production design, costume design, cinematography, director Yorgos Lanthimos, and Best Picture of the Year. Awards eligible in all categories.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn, and now an episode from Song Exploder. That's the podcast hosted by our friend Hrishikesh Hirway, in which he sits down with musicians and has them deconstruct one of their songs. Hrishi usually chats with artists from a wide range of pop music styles, but in this episode, he sits down with Yo-Yo Ma, perhaps the most famous cellist in the world. Yo-Yo Ma was born in Paris in 1955. He moved with his family to the United States when he was 7 years old and performed for President Kennedy that year. Yo-Yo Ma played at Carnegie Hall for the first time when he was just 16, and he's won 18 Grammys and has been awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. For this special episode of Song Exploder, Yo-Yo Ma breaks down a signature piece from his repertory. It's one of the most famous compositions written for the cello, the prelude from Johann Sebastian Bach's Cello Suite No. 1 in G major. Yo-Yo Ma first recorded the Bach cello suites in 1983, then again in 1998. Now at age 62, he's recorded them for what he says may be the last time. It's for an album called Six Evolutions, Bach Cello Suites. The beloved cellist spoke with Hrishikesh Hirway about what has changed in his approach to this piece of music.
My name's Yo-Yo Ma. The prelude came into my life when I was 4 years old. It was literally the first piece of music I learned. I think I've performed the prelude 100 times, maybe more. And 58 years later, I'm still learning from it.
Who introduced this piece of music to you?
My father. He loved Bach. He was in Paris during the Second World War, and they had blackout nights, no lights, and he played violin. So during the day, he would learn the Bach sonatas and partitas off of violin by heart. And then at night, because you can't do anything else, he played the music.
So you started playing the cello and this music when you were 4 years old? You must have had to play like a quarter-sized cello.
I had a 16th-sized cello.
Oh, that's so
yeah,
cute.
Yeah, it's really cute. And I was, so in Paris, there was no chair that was low enough. So my first lesson took place at the violin dealer's place, and I sat on three telephone books.
That's just too cute.
So how does a four-year-old kid start playing Bach suites? It sounds hard, but if you actually think of it, the beginning of the suite goes. These are open strings, and you put one finger down, and then again, open string. That's a pattern that anybody can learn. So that's day one out of 42 measures. So the next day, you use two fingers. That's day two, and so on and so forth. So it's actually quite simple. So I had an early start, and by the time I recorded for the first time, I'd already been playing them for 24 years.
I want to play the first version that you recorded of this in 1983. How does it sound to you now?
Very good cello playing. The notes are very even. You know, everything is just very measured, very competent. Good cellist.
It feels like a backhanded compliment a little bit.
Well, you know, it's good playing, but I try and do forensic musical analysis. Okay, what does this evidence say? What does this person know? What do they care about? The person cares about having a nice sound. This person likes to make things look good, right? But this music, it starts your imagination going, where's he taking us? And then I see, well, there's this stop in the middle. Has that person thought about that great interruption? I'd say maybe subliminally a little bit, but not something that is front and center. It's basically, let's get this over with and stop. No silence, no silence. Let's go. But that pause, it's something totally violently unusual. It screams out at saying, something happened.
Okay, I want to play that same spot, the moment where there's that break, in your new recording, in the 2018 version. What does your forensic analysis tell you about the person who's recorded that version?
There's more attention to changing landscape. There's less emphasis on saying, let's make a beautiful sound, and there's different kinds of texture, there's greater fragility, there's more attention to the bits of landscape that says, wait, look at that, check that out. Like a great book that you read several times during your life, each time you read it, it's the same book, but you certainly get very, very different material from the same story. He says, oh, I didn't see that. Oh, I didn't notice that before. I'm not trying to prove anything other than this is the best I can do. I make mistakes, but, you know, I accept I'm not perfect. The reason I want to record this, perhaps for the last time, is that I feel this is what I can contribute. This is the best that I can do for the music that's written for my instrument.
That was Yo-Yo Ma talking about the prelude from Bach's Cello Suite No. 1 in G major. You can hear a longer version of that session at songexploder.net. And that's The Frame for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.